accession number 19922, reel 7.
Barry Smith, reel 7.
Yeah, I'll continue now with the conditions. In the winter, as I say, it could get down to 40 below in the winds. The summer could be very hot. The monsoon season, continual rain as prevalent with monsoon affected countries. I can remember training prior to go up the line in monsoon rains, and also badgered by mosquitoes. It's awful, you might say, but it's all part of the game at that time. When in the line, as I say, we couldn't kill these rats by firing off, as some people suggested, because they only attract fire or alert people unnecessarily. Eating and cooking was, and washing, and it's all very, very basic, very rudimentary. And one, as you might say, is just a form of existence, really, living in dugouts. The thing that affected me personally more than anything else in the Korean War was the shelling. It affected my hearing, but it didn't affect me when I came out of the army. It was years later that they discovered that it was my loss of hearing was caused by a shell blast, because my voice had always been very resonant, and people have remarked on it that I talk louder than I should do. It's different when you're taking commands or what have you in the fire brigade. You're also very much younger. When you get old, your ears deteriorate anyhow. But the amount of shell fire that we used to get just after Pimlico and when my period in the line was quite considerable. And I think the most terrifying thing really is that you hope that the earth can literally swallow you up on occasions when they're shelling. You get them coming in one every few seconds, and you're very vulnerable. You don't you know that there's nothing that you can do about it, and you just hope to God that you're going to live through it and see your family again. That's all that's in your mind on an occasion like that. When it happens to you and you're out on an operation, you just get on with it and hope to God that everything will be all right. As I say, we weren't foolhardy. We might be a very, very proud of our regiment, or have a certain ambience or swagger in doing our job at that time. There was a certain ambience with the 1st Battalion. It's just difficult to explain. But I wouldn't say cocky. Cocky is not the word for it. It's we certainly felt that we were not bulletproof, but we were very well trained, and we were fusiliers, and nothing was going to happen to us. Can I finish on this second?
Did the political side of the Korean War mean anything to you?
No. I think we had been, as I say, drafted out as part of the Commonwealth Division, 28th Brigade, been drafted out there to do a job. You didn't know what you were going into. It all seemed all much bigger than yourself. And I suppose you felt safety in within your own regiment. I think if you were with your colleagues, you felt that is where the safety was, that's what kept you together, the fact you're part of an organised regiment. But the political side, we knew it was political. We wondered what the hell we were doing there, why we were there, to use it in I don't want to swear in that sense, but what the hell we were doing there. It was all, as I say, out of our control. So I suppose you were presented with this and just had to get on with it. We seemed it was all a bit futile in that sense. Most wars, I think, ultimately are political or religious or what have you, aren't they? Most of us felt that some of them felt we just do the job and look forward to doing our stint of duty and getting home. I think that runs through most soldiers, most people at that time. And coming home in one piece in that sense. I think that's as most you could hope for. You completely cut off from that side of it. It was as though you... it was all much bigger than yourself. And as I say, you felt very... As I mentioned this before, you felt quite alone with so many people there, quite alone, quite vulnerable, really, because it was something that was out of your control. You only could control what I've previously mentioned about activities and what we did. If you could control that.
Did your period in Korea leave you with any long-term effects?
Yes. But not bad health or wounds in that sense, other than my hearing. It made a marked impression upon me. I don't know if that's good or bad. I felt then, hard to explain, felt that when I came out, all I wanted to do was... I felt that I wanted to... it's hard to explain. I'm a tennis player, as you know, and the fact that I can run around a tennis court, even today, the fact I can run around and smell the fresh English air, as it were. I've always been a sportsman, and this is a feeling common to me, myself and my late father, who shared the same interest in sport, all sport. The fact we can do this is a real joy, and the fact that I've been allowed to continue that activity or return to this country basically unimpaired, except for my hearing or from the mental point of view, which made a more impression on me than anything else. It's be able to run around a tennis court again, as it were, and to know that sort of freedom. It's very hard to explain. Sounds a bit odd when I talk of it like that. I'm talking as a sportsman rather than another person. Does that sound a load of rubbish to you?
Not at all. Did you?
It's very hard to explain.
Did you?
I've always been that way, you see. The joy of always being able to do that has always been with me in my personal life. I was a great sportsman at public school, and it stayed with me. My father was ex-Wimbledon tennis player, and you can imagine the fact I would get back to that tennis court again. Sounds silly, doesn't it?
Did
all you? All I want to do is get, you know.
Do you ever have any nightmares about Korea?
Are you going to recall this or not? Yeah. You referring to nightmares, that would be the wrong word to put against it. I have had, on and off, when I've been disturbed about something or stressed about something, either by a personal, my daughter's health at one time when she was a young child, I had dreams, and these dreams tend to be not something that affects your health seriously, like they like shell shock can affect your health seriously, although I had a bit of that, I'm sure. But certainly when I came out of the army, I felt that I'd been a bit shaken up, to say the least. But of course that goes when you recuperate and in your own country. But I have this dream, and it tends to be the same, where, as I've explained to you earlier, we were being chased by an enemy patrol, and we just made the safety of our own positions. And it's so realistic that you could think it was happening. And when you wake up, and I waked up, my wife was quite perturbed about this at one time, because she said that going back and joining regimental associations or going on remembrance parades will only exasperate your mental health. That is to say, she got me into a decent... I was in good health, and when I had these occasional bouts, she said that it didn't do me any good at all. She's never been a person for, although our family have all been in the army in the last war, as most families had someone in the services. She's never been one, as you say, all things military or service, though she understands it. She thinks possibly I should forget. You can't bring back the dead, and you should forget it. You live very much. You should think about the future. Well, as a sportsman, I do think about the future. It's rather hard to explain that, but when the only way I can explain that really is if I go to a remembrance parade, and I stand there in the line, and there's people there I know that have been in active service with me. And the fact that we're all standing there and we're able to still stand there and be fit and well, it's a wonderful feeling. It's quite a feeling of great pride in a way. The fact that you'd made it, you were able to get through it and acquit yourself in a decent way.
So,
like a fusilier.
So you feel that having reunions doesn't harm you?
No, it doesn't me. We don't harbour on the past in the morbid sense, what have you. But it's a feeling of great pride. It's very hard to explain to a person who doesn't understand these. Some people might say it's banging the drum and swinging the lamps, as it were, and a lot of nonsense of men playing toy soldiers again. But for me, it's not that at all. It's a feeling that it goes very much deeper than that. The fact that I'm up there and I see people there that I know have been through the same situation as myself. And it's a great pride, it's a sense of achievement in a way. The fact that one has been able to serve one's country, they do say, of course, although I don't know if I can... have this attribute, a selfish attribute, is that to serve one's country is the greatest thing you can do. But I think it's something much bigger than yourself to have served your country and to have got through a difficult situation. I've got army friends who went through the last war very badly, knocked about in Salerno and Anzio. A very dear friend of ours, and he's badly, he's crippled now, but he's a lovely person, and his feelings is the fact that you're alive and well, and you're able to do these things, and you should be very grateful. And I think it's gratitude, really, grateful, that makes me feel that way. Some people, I never used to belong to the association until some years ago. I met someone who was an officer in the Fusiliers, and he said, "You of all people should join." He said, "Because you're entitled to do so. You've served your time. You've done time with the colours, and you should be very proud that you've fulfilled that task and what have you. And it's along those lines that I joined, really. Just one small thing about, you're talking about the conditions in Korea. We would be out on patrol, that is, on manoeuvres, prior to going up the line, and you'd see, or moving up the line, and you'd see refugees, that's what we would call them. Refugees, obviously, families disturbed by the war, going from one area to another. It's, on one occasion, there was a family a family of Koreans by the side of the road, and the woman was having a baby by the side of the road. Such was the conditions in the country then. Everything had been all aspects of the country had been ruined. That is, the crops, the general way of going on, their culture had all been fragmented because of the war. And you see things of this on the television about refugees in any war. And I remember we were on one occasion, this was on training manoeuvres prior to going up the line, and the personnel in the regiment, medical personnel, would insist that we dug these trenches 12 feet deep, if possible. I remember that, 12 feet. And twice the size of a normal burial. And any food which we had cooked in the kitchens, field kitchens, well, we didn't eat, would be thrown down these trenches, because disease and flies and rats would be attracted very easily by any rubbish left in the line by any regiment. We took over from the Princess Pats up in the line as a member. I've told you we've taken over from other regiments. So on one occasion, the Princess Pat, the Canadian regiment, they weren't too careful about where they chucked their army, their old food tins that were scattered all over the place. Immediately the Sergeant Major instructed all of us to clean the trenches up, because it was attracting rats and vermin all over the place. This, of course, spreads disease, as you know. And the British medical officers would stamp on it pretty quickly. That's what I said about organisation of a regiment. It was just not about fighting, it's about living in the line, which is you're faced with the conditions just to get on with it. And but the Korean children immediately dumped the food, would dive down the trench and scoop it out. That's something that stayed on my mind forever and a day. The conditions caused by the ravages of war. You see it on the television now. You know, it's nothing new in the television media now, but it was new to us. We come from a civilised country. You're now faced to this. And it makes an impression on your mind. The harsh conditions. I believe now that the land of extremes, you know, Japan is like that, they tell me. But when you come from a civilised country and you're confronted with that, it makes a marked impression on your mind forever and a day. It's something that you can forget, and you do forget it. I mean, you don't go through your life every day on the tennis court, I don't think about it, never think about it. But you think when you come back to your own country after being in a campaign like this, and you think how lucky you are to be fit and healthy and to have got through it and been subjected to those conditions and seen the natives of the country, that's it, subjected to it. It leaves an enduring impression upon you. That's what makes you so proud to have been part of a decent regiment and have got through it. It's very hard to explain to you that feeling. The amount of regimental pride, or pride in yourself, or what have you. Some experts can put their finger right on it in few words. I can't. Yeah.
Did you sing songs in Korea?
Yes. And we went back reserve on occasions to have a rest. have showers or clean up, what have you. They used to have beer tents, and other regiments would get in there, like the Maoris. Can you stop the tape? Yeah, we would be in, if you went back from the reserve to have a rest, we would, and it wasn't often the case with myself, funnily enough, because a lot of them would be taken out in groups from the line and sent on rest and recuperation, as they used to call it, and they would be sent to places in southern Korea and to Kure in Japan, or Tokyo in Japan. And I wasn't lucky enough to be sent on that. I went on a 3-day rest and recuperation rest down to I think near Kure. We entertained, and you had time to rest and write letters and have a drink and what have you. General sort of relaxation from the rigours of being in the front line. And they used to call, I'll digress from the Maoris, I'll get back to that in a minute, but the use rest and recuperation used to be called by some as rack and ruin, because they would go to Japan, and obviously a lot of them would try and find a girl or two, and they used to say it's more rack and ruin than it was rest and recuperation. However, that's just an army joke in that sense. But the reason I wasn't given too much leave out of the line is that signallers were not too many. As I've explained earlier on, there was only two of us, or maybe three of us, to a company. We really couldn't be spared out of the line for any protracted periods. So to give us a week off to go to Japan just wasn't given to me. They couldn't spare me. Now, I may be criticised by this, by the fusiliers listening to this, and might say, well, you know, that's all old baloney. But because there weren't that many trained signallers, we didn't get the leave that I could have had. But I did have breaks. But coming back to this, where we would go back from the front line to rest areas, you'd have obviously things like beer tents, and because you couldn't get beer in the line, we had rum, which was issued to us before we went out on patrol, our naval rum. This was called former French courage. what they call it?
Dutch courage.
Dutch courage. Misquote. And obviously to keep you warm on patrol at night in the cold of the winter. But they had beer tents, and you'd get other regiments in there. You get the Australians, you get the New Zealands, other Commonwealth brigade troops. As you know, the Commonwealth's made up of other countries at that time. So I think it's one of the first United Nations conventional wars, of the first one there was, if I remember rightly. And you get Turkish troops and all sorts of sections in there. But the Maoris, after a few drinks, the Maoris had glorious voices and would entertain us with all the songs, what have you. There are lots of songs that were sung, and these are all down in a book, funnily enough, but there was a song which is called Going On, which we'd sing, which is the actual words are recorded in a book I've got upstairs. Yes, one thing that's just come to my mind about things that make an impression on your mind, considered might be funny, certainly amusing, to a British soldier, traditionally trained, certainly in the 1950s, when we were being transported up the line or to and from places, That is where the lorries were allowed to run, because when you got near the line, you had to march up, obviously. The American trucks were driven by Canadians. Canadians at that time always seemed to be a cigar stuck in the corner of their mouth. And these drivers are called the Vandoos. And they seem to be completely mad crowd of drivers. They would drive, I believe, the ammunition trucks as well. And as I've explained, would tear down these roads, leaving spaces between them, creating a lot of dust, obviously, from one place to the other. The ammunition runs, as they would call them. And these, they're quite characters, these Vandoos. You may have heard them. They may be mentioned by other Korean veterans about the peculiar other regiments, other armies that were there. The Americans, for example, I remember the American jeep came to the back part of our position when I was in the line, and they wanted us to, have we got any boots we could sell them? Because the British Army boots at that time, rubber commando boots, were much sought after by the Americans, who British boots were slightly superior to the Americans, and they would come and do a bit of trade, as it were. You know, we weren't allowed to sell our equipment, and obviously we'd be charged by it being on the mat. The sergeant major and the officers through selling your equipment. But that's one of the things. The equipment we have was quite good. It wasn't at the start of the Korean War, so I understand. But the modern equipment we had, we couldn't have existed without, not in the winter.